Podcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Catherine Hickey Snyder in honor of her husband, Matthew Snyder, on their 23rd wedding anniversary.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Did you know that containers and packaging represent the largest segment of U.S. municipal solid waste with 32% or 75 million tons? That's about 300 pounds per person for each one of us each year. On the program today, we'll take a look at packaging, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll talk about packaging and how it shapes our world and how we might make smarter, more sustainable choices about the goods we buy. Our guest today is Daniel Imhoff. He's interested in issues related to food, agriculture, forestry, and design, and he is the author of Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. The book features the photographs of Roberto Cara. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Daniel Imhoff is the executive director of a nonprofit communications agency called Watershed Media. Imhoff and photographer Cara have teamed up for four previous books, including Farming with the Wild, Enhancing Biodiversity on Farms and Ranches. Farming with the Wild and the new book, Paper or Plastic, are published by Sierra Club Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Daniel Imhoff, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Sure. You know, my supermarket has stopped asking that question, paper or plastic. You'll get plastic unless you ask for paper. The question, when it was asked, did serve to remind us that we have choices to make. When did stores stop asking, and where do you think we are in terms of that reminder that we're part of the problem, we're part of the solution?
Yeah, good question. You know, I actually thought that this question would be over and done with a long, long time ago. In a former career or early in my writing life, one of my very first jobs was to write hang tags for these reusable cloth bags that were being made out of leftover fabric scraps. And you know, just to kind of come up with a simple reminder to people that, you know, the best answer to the paper or plastic conundrum is neither. Just bring your own, have this thing, and those have your own bag that's more or less permanent. And more than 15 years since I did that job, I'm still toting around tons of those bags in my car, you know, to do anything from carry sweaty yoga clothes to, you know, bring home the groceries and things like that. I mean, we use them all the time. And I think that there's something in us that wants a definitive answer. Just mm-hmm. tell me the right thing to do, and mm-hmm. then I can, you know, get on with my shopping experience and get on with my day. And so while paper or plastic, I called the book Paper or Plastic to try to tap into that everyday reminder that we have that when we're buying things, we make these choices, and these choices have an impact on the world. I think, actually, I hope that the more you study that question, the more questions you ask and the deeper you go. Because I don't think it really necessarily matters if you're using a paper or plastic bag. They're both going to be thrown away, probably, maybe reused a little, but they're not going to have an extended life. And there are really much better ways to do, you know, the basic things that we need to keep ourselves alive.
Yeah. Well, everything that we buy, just about everything, comes in a package. You know, we buy packaged goods and we take them home, we take them to work, we take them on the road in the car with us. It's all around us. At the same time, it really seems invisible. Is that, in fact, because packaging is everywhere?
Well, packaging, quite literally, it delivers the stuff of our lives.
Right.
You know, and so, I mean, packaging is extremely practical. And I think that there's definitely something in us that we're traders, and we're producers, and we're craftspeople living in an industrial society. And I think then once you take off the, once you peel back that veneer of really the industrial world that we live in, and some of the roles that you might not think of that packaging plays in that industrial world, then you can get to a deeper level. For example, the single-serving container is really a post-World War II phenomenon. Prior to World War II, we really bought things a lot more locally, and we might have had some single-serving containers and things like that, but they were refillable, and they weren't necessarily just this one-way disposable commodity that we have today. Today, on a daily basis, we Americans consume 300 million cups. That's a hot or cold beverage cup, about one plastic bag per person, so almost 300 million bags, 45 million bottles of water. One out of every three servings of water we drink from a plastic bottle, and most of these things are getting thrown away. Now, you know, they feed our convenience lifestyle and our very high-speed, you know, on-the-run lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, though, that people might not understand is that in our industrialized world, our packages are incredibly engineered. And they're engineered to such an extent that the things that they package have shelf life so much shorter than the package of themselves. So you might consume a cup of coffee in, or let's say a slushy or something, in a matter of half an hour. But if it's packaged in styrofoam, that styrofoam is going to outlast the statues of the Italian Renaissance. I mean, a lot of, you know, so there's this complete disconnection between what something is packaging and then how long it's going to last. And obviously the package has a role, because if it doesn't do its job, then it squanders even more resources than it took to make the package. But you have to understand that a lot of the materials that we're relying on, they're completely out of whack with natural cycles. And I think the burden is becoming increasingly obvious.
Mm.
Another role that people might not quite think of readily is that, and I didn't say this, a pop culture historian, Thomas Hine, who writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, wrote a book on packaging, and he says that the primary role of a package is to take the place of human relationships, which can be irritable and unreliable and hard to deal with packages that are slick and a little bit more glamorous. And they don't really talk back to you. So basically, we have now switched from a world in which we had a lot closer interactions from the people who made things and also sold them kind of on the country store, you know, 5 and 10 level, to a world in which we live in these big box stores and this increasingly packaged world where we just have more relations with packages. And the packages tell us a certain amount of information, but they also create this huge distance between where something was made and by whom and under what conditions, and the actual package itself, the product itself.
Daniel Imhoff, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting on line one with us in Champaign-Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello, interesting comment, please, on things like fish and chips. They used to be served in newspapers. Maybe now they don't want the ink, but then some countries use plastic bags for everything. They don't have a separate styrofoam. They just put ice and soda pop in a plastic bag, and that serves to go. And there was once a serious study, I think, by Little and Company on the value of they couldn't reach a conclusion on nappies. They studied a great detail and couldn't figure out how to account for all of the costs in the cloth diaper services, which were popular years ago, and disposables. And comment, thanks.
Okay.
Well, first, the plastic in other countries. It's as other countries adopt our to-go lifestyle and ways of basically eating and drinking. 60% of all packaging materials are used for food and beverages. And excuse me, I have a little allergy here. So 60% of everything we package really goes for food and drink. And we talked a little bit about how that's feeding this convenience society. And as other countries in Asia, in China particularly, are moving from a much more traditional sit down in a restaurant if possible, but mainly buy it every day at the market, take it home, cook it fresh, etc., to a real takeout economy, they've developed these huge over-packaging problems. In China, they call those plastics white pollution or white garbage, and that's because if you're driving through the countryside now, on the train, you can see just these plastic packages blowing by almost in a blizzard-like effect. And it's to such an extent that many municipalities are trying to ban certain types of takeout packaging and desperately seeking solutions that maybe are agricultural-based so that they can be composted and at least turned into some other material and not be this blight on the landscape. And even in Kenya, the recent Nobel Prize winner, Wangari Maathai, who is the tree-planting activist, local economy activist there, and she's a minister of the environment, she has asked that the country ban plastic bags there. The reason is because they blow around, and then they become these little puddles and breeding grounds for mosquitoes and then vectors for malaria. So These lives of packages that live on, they can have all kinds of effects, and even when we're using them efficiently. And then I guess, let me see, that bumps up onto the second question about the diapers and, you know, disposable versus reusable, and how do you measure it out? And, excuse me, you can do these life cycle analysis. They're really, really hard to get ever complete about anything, and I think that really the best studies are on a case-by-case basis, and as you know, engaged citizens, we have to do the best homework we can and then make decisions and try to live well with them. You know, I personally think that a reusable solution is always or usually better than a disposable one. But I think, you know, you could get many scientists to argue it both ways. But what you cannot disagree with is when you have 6 billion people and the rate, just the increasing rate of affluence that we have and materials that we consume, all of us, then, you know, it becomes a little clearer. Wow, every little decision can actually have a pretty significant impact.
Mm. Those old three R's of waste reduction, reduce, reuse, recycle, does that remain a useful way for us as consumers to think about our choices?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can add a whole bunch of R's to that. But, you know, reduction, definitely, I think. when you look at packaging, by the time you decide to, you have that package and you decide to recycle it, or and that could mean it goes into some refill loop or it goes into some recycle manufacturing loop, or it even gets incinerated. In some countries, they even count incineration as recycling because they can potentially generate energy from that incineration, or even just disposal in the landfill. By the time that decision is being made, the damage has been done. 99% of much of the damage in making a package is done in the forests and in the oil fields and in the manufacturing facilities and in all the transportation and other energy that and resources that are embodied in the making of a package. It's only about 1% of the energy in the picking it up and collecting it and getting it to its next, you know, stage of life, if there's going to be one. And so reduction, eliminating the need for the package in the first place, is the most significant thing that you can do. And reusing, coming up with some kind of system that uses those resources over and over and over. And normally, in order to do that, you're talking about a system where things aren't traveling huge amounts of miles, although that's not always the case, but that usually makes those kind of economics work. Reusing something is second, and I think the life cycle analysis really bears that out. And then finally, at least giving these materials another life. Recycling, reprocessing materials generally uses a lot less energy and water and other important resources than making them from virgin ones.
Yeah. It was striking to me to think about this issue in as you presented in Paper or Plastic, and that is the thing about recycling is that it can have an effect on us where we say, well, I can just recycle this. You know, so we don't think any more critically than that, and apparently we're recycling less than we used to.
Yeah, that's a shocker, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I live in California, and so we have some pretty high state-mandated recovery targets throughout the state. 2000 was our first one, and we had to recover 50%. Municipalities had to recover 50% of what was going into the landfill for recycling. And those municipalities didn't make it, faced serious fines. And now the next target, I think, is late this decade, and it's more in the 75% level. And that's And what you find, I think, in almost anything, you know, it's pretty easy to get the low-hanging fruit in the first 50%, and then getting those next percentages, every jump becomes an exponential jump and requires a lot more education and effort and all kinds of things to get to those next higher levels. In Sonoma County, where I live, they were a little frustrated with the curbside collections. And they allowed everybody to just throw all the recyclables in one bin. And what they found was they, even though they got about a 5% of contamination of trash by people doing that, they got a 30% rise in participation. So I think, and Sonoma County, I feel that we're pretty educated and sort of, you know, good citizens out here. We have a pretty high understanding of environmental issues, and we want to do the right thing, and yet we're still not even motivated enough to do something simple like sort out the recyclables properly. And so on the one hand, that made me pretty frustrated that, you know, all of a sudden we just throw everything in one bin and let everybody be lazy, and yet the results bear out that it really works, that, you know, people don't want to try that hard, and you have to make it easy for them.
Yeah, convenience is a big part of the picture here.
Yeah. You know, and things are going to change. I think I heard that oil prices fell a little bit today, but I do think that there's no question that we're on the verge of a sea change in the petroleum regime in the world. How much is left, who's going to get it, how expensive it's going to be, how it's going to change. I hope the way that we just sort of blithely transport things around and use valuable limited resources in a way that we might regret in a little while. So I think that some things are going to change, and it's going to become a little more expensive soon to be wasteful, and hopefully that might be a motivating factor on some level.
Daniel Imhoff, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to a caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. My girlfriend just told me that she thinks that there is a bag charge in California, and you were just speaking about California, so I assume you would have said that if that was actually the case. But if it's not the case, you think it would be, of course, it would be a great idea for grocery stores to implement just a minimal 2-cent, 3-cent charge for bags. I know some stores around here actually give credit for bags when you reuse them. But similar to the concept for buying a, bottles and cans in New York, you have to pay 5-cent deposits, and I think virtually 99% of the cans in New York get recycled. What about a bag charge?
Yeah, it's a great question. Let's just get back to what you just said about states with bottle bills. They're the states that have the highest rates of recovery of containers, no doubt about it. So when there's been an economic incentive applied, it basically works. It creates that positive feedback that the market needs to recover those materials. The bag tax that you're talking about is being considered. It hasn't yet been adopted. It's at the city council and sort of sitting there in San Francisco. What they're proposing is a 17-cent per bag, paper or plastic, at the checkout line.
Wow.
And that is to basically cover the cost of recovery and what you're going to do with those bags, but also to have an education campaign and support some kind of efforts to get a whole pool of reusable bags in the San Francisco area. So, to just kind of create quickly a systemic solution for this problem. San Francisco might get beat out by either Oakland or Mill Valley, which are neighboring municipalities, who are also considering that kind of a tax levy. Now, Ireland has something called a plast tax that I'm aware of. It's a 5-cent per plastic bag tax, and it apparently has been extremely successful in that country in greatly reducing the number of disposable bags that are used.
You think a 5 or 17-cent tax on bags would take away from the incentive of putting, say, like a single card or a single piece of fruit in a whole plastic bag?
You know, one certainly would hope. I kind of came up with some myths of packaging, some that I thought were, pretty basic, and some that were counterintuitive as I wrote this book and thought hard about it. And I think two myths apply here. One is, A, change can be legislated. So, for example, in Finland, they made an ordinance in the mid-90s that every bottled beverage sold in Finland had to come in a refillable container. And almost within a few years, they accomplished that. And they also did the same thing with produce sold in corrugated boxes. They completely went to either recyclable corrugated or reusable plastic containers for produce. So in some cases, I think you can legislate change on some real strong fundamental level. But there's other places when I don't think that no matter how hard you try, you can't change people's behavior with legislation.
Yeah, I'd agree more with your first proposition that I do think the change through legislation can be made. more so. I agree with both points, actually, but the first one I think is particularly relevant. I think some people don't want to be inconvenienced, and some people I think are just unaware when they put like an apple into a bag and then they seal it up and they self-package all of their produce or cards or anything like that. In the checkout line, the cashiers are bag pushers. I mean, yeah, I, you know, always request no bag, and sometimes they forget, and I just say it. You know, I already said I didn't want a bag. You know, didn't want a bag. So, I don't know. I think legislation's a good way to go.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a case-by-case thing, and hopefully maybe you guys can beat San Francisco to this old plastic bag tax.
I wouldn't hold my breath on that. You know, it is interesting, though, in coffee shops around town, if you bring your own cup, you bring your own mug, glass, whatever, you get a discount. 25 cents is typical on a beverage, but yet I still see lots of paper cups going out the door, and yours truly guilty.
Well, you should probably see a lot of double cups going out the door, too.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics on that, I think, are striking. There's a group called the Alliance for Environmental Innovation, and they're a project of environmental defense, and they've worked with a lot of companies, UPS and Federal Express and others, to kind of, you know, make some significant changes in their behavior. They work with the Postal Service on their envelopes and things, and they did a study about 5 years ago with Starbucks, and Starbucks was basically, you know, forced with, they're one of the largest purchasers of disposable cups in the country, and they did a study, and also they were hoping to encourage people to stay in the stores and in their cafes, and they have a lot of empty dishwasher space because they're mainly often, you know, quickly cycling through the steamed milk containers, the stainless steel milk containers, and spoons and things like that, but they have half-empty dishwashers that they're running, and so they tried to do this study. Well, what is the difference between the ceramic cup and the paper or the styrofoam cup? And they found that basically staying in the cafe and using the reusable cup, it saves between 85 and 99% of all the water, the greenhouse gases, the solid waste impacts and emissions as a disposable cup does. You know, the reusable cup, it takes 70 times before it breaks even with the paper or the styrofoam, but it lasts at least 1,000 times. Some of these cups last 3,000 uses. And so just the simple act of carrying your own mug, or even better, just staying in the cafe and taking those 5 minutes to visit with a friend or do some, you know, write your notes down or whatever you need to do, just collect your thoughts, enjoy your coffee or your chai or whatever, that has a huge impact.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Morris County on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting topic today, and I had a couple of comments. I wanted to make the writer of the book aware of a resource called Project Learning Tree, which I have used with my students, but there's one activity that I thought of right away when I heard him talking. It's called A Peek at Packaging, and it has the students evaluate packaging in great detail, describing how far it's traveled, what the parts are. It's kind of an interdisciplinary thing because they have to use math to estimate how much is, you know, what material. But then they also decide if the product or the package is reusable, biodegradable. So they really look at it in detail, and then they bring in some packaging, some items that are packaged from home. And we always found the worst items were things that were fundraising items that the kids would sell because they'd be wrapped in shrink wrap and then metal and then all sorts of stuff and for some little bitty product inside. So I felt that was a good way for kids and adults to be aware of how much packaging there is. And then my other question or comment, you'd mentioned getting extra packaging and mail and the junk mail. Is there still a number or an address, some kind of a clearinghouse for eliminating unwanted junk mail from our mailboxes? And I'll hang up and see if you have any comments.
Okay.
Yeah, I last question. I don't know the answer to that junk mail. I know there still is. So I think if you have access and you can Google, how do I get my name taken off junk mail lists, I think that you can find that no problem. We've done that fairly successfully in our family, but they just seem to keep getting me by phone and automatic voicemail and fax. And I mean, you're constantly vigilant to break yourself free. And even then, I think one of the most heinous bad raps that I found in doing the book was the AOL CDs that come America Online. I find them really invasive and offensive and overpackaged. You know, it's amazing the things that they come wrapped in. The Project Learning Tree, it sounds really good. You know, I mean, I can't stress enough, packaging is not our biggest problem. So maybe the best thing that packaging can do is to serve as a kind of regular reminder to us that, hey, we have to make these decisions, we're having these impacts, and, you know, how do we make good choices?
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Daniel Imhoff, our guest today, author of Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, there are so many things that are shipped to us. We buy a lot through catalogs, junk mail, over the internet, that kind of thing. You talked a moment ago about shippers. I think you mentioned UPS. What can you tell us about the shipping industry in terms of how things are being packaged? How are packages, pallets, the peanuts or the packing material, is that being examined? Is there a better way to do it? What's out there?
Yeah, there are. You know, and as I said, we live in this global world, and I think when you look behind some of the things that get, let's say, a pair of mittens or something to a store, it might be absolutely shocking how many times it traveled from the time it was made and finally assembled across the country a few times before it's finally packaged and then sent to a distribution center and then out to a store. So these things are traveling quite a lot. And in order to make, so the primary package is the package itself. Let's just say it's a yogurt container. And then there are secondary packages as well, and that could be, you know, a cardboard box with a shrink wrap that carries six different yogurt containers, and then that might be packed in boxes on a pallet that's also shrink wrapped, and that's the tertiary package, the transport packaging. So there's three different levels of it. Let's go to the pallets. There are anywhere between 1 and 2 billion pallets in circulation in North America every year just to keep things moving around. And in order to replenish that pallet fleet, because so many of these pallets are kind of cheaply made, they're really one-way disposable pallets. We introduce another 500 million new pallets every year in the United States. It takes 40% of all the hardwood that's harvested, 10% of all wood, all lumber that's harvested on a yearly basis go to making pallets. It's enough wood by volume to frame about 300,000 new houses. So it's a significant amount of material. And it's a significant amount of material that really it gets. Most of these pallets, 90%, get used one time, and then they're either chipped or incinerated. They can get turned into mulch, or they're incinerated and burned, or even sometimes thrown in the landfill. another thing is, though, in this international world, pallets, you know, they come from different countries. The wood has different sources, and they become vectors for invasive species that sometimes have really bad effects back here on the landscape. One of the most prominent ones that we know of is the Asian longhorn beetle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beetle that eats hardwoods. It came from China on shipping pallets. And I heard an NPR story the other day where these fire troopers, paratroopers, were climbing in Central Park to try to beat back these beetles because, you know, they're having... They're creating a real blight on the trees in Central Park. So, excuse me, in order to fight back that, internationally, pallets that move internationally have to either be heat-treated or fumigated. They're often fumigated with methyl bromide, which is a really incredibly potent biocide. It's a known ozone depleter. It's a really, really harsh chemical that we use to treat these pallets. The government is looking at pallets and actually has done a real admirable job. A number of years ago, they switched from wood to plastic, recycled plastic pallets for their entire fleet that we now move the mail around on, hundreds and thousands of pallets. And they've basically eliminated that connection between packaging and the forest. It's an important one because about 75% of all packaging materials come from the forest. They're wood-based, and that's you know. So when you talk about forest products are renewable and therefore they're better than plastic, which is a finite resource and it's petroleum, those questions aren't always as cut and dried as you might think.
Yeah. What's new in terms of those horrible peanuts.
Peanuts.
Yeah, those styrofoam peanuts.
Yeah, well, you know, it just air. Air is one thing that people are trying. You know, you're trying mm-hmm. to absorb shock. Sometimes you're merely trying to fill empty space, which is really unfortunate that, you know, we haven't really learned to minimize the empty space with better systems. You know, peanuts are just a drag because they're hard to collect. They're going to last forever. They end up blowing around, and it's really hard to see the value in them. You'd think that their time is over.
Yeah. Anything in terms of a replacement for them at this point?
Well, you know, actually trying to have a package that is as form-fitting to its product as possible is a really good start, and the air I think is a much better alternative. You know, ultimately those things could be made out of some kind of polyethylene that is recyclable, and there's a market for it, and hopefully collectible. I see things going in that direction.
Yeah. Maybe we could come up with a kind of a bioplastic thing that air could be pumped into that. And
Yeah, you know, I mean, certainly I saw these things that were made out of popcorn. They were French. They were these rolls of gauzy material with popcorn in them. And then you've got the starch-based peanuts that are dissolvable. Rodents really like them. That's a real drawback, and they are dissolvable. You know, they are not resilient to water. They're not water resistant, so that can be kind of a problem. But it also gets back to then, and back there, you're pretty close to the heart of the Corn Belt,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are proposing, well, let's switch from petroleum based plastics and foams, those kind of resins, to corn-based. And, you know, the production of corn has its own problems. Certainly, we subsidize corn to the extent that, you know, we have these huge surpluses of it, and so it's a real cheap feedstock. So it's pretty, I think it's logical that people are trying to figure out, well, what else can we do with it? It's already, you know, in most of our processed foods and making us really fat. We might as well package all that stuff in it as well. And then you have to really, you know, then you get down to the nitty-gritty things about, well, what is the real impact of growing corn? How much energy does it require relative to making something out of petroleum? Do we have then to set up this whole new collection system so that it doesn't contaminate the other petroleum-based plastic resins that, that we use? I mean, there, it just opens up a huge number of questions of which I don't think a lot of good answers are out there yet.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm interested in intermodal transportation, and I'm wondering what that what effect that has on packaging. It's a fairly modern way of moving railroad freight, and from big hubs in places like Chicago and Los Angeles across the country to places like New Orleans or Miami or New York, most of the products that are being shipped are shipped in shipping crates.
Yeah.
And I think that once you package, you don't have to do like park a semi and get some unloading device to run through the semi. It comes in a crate that I think probably reduces the volume of packaging needed. Mm-hmm. Have you anything to say about that?
Well, I'm not an expert on it. I've seen some really interesting crate designs where, you know, that they'd be it'd be a big square for a big cube, and could even have a liquid in it. So it could even have a some kind of a polypropylene pouch that's carrying tomato paste or something. And then once it's gotten to where it's going, it can be broken down to like one quarter of its size if it doesn't come back full. I mean, That's always, isn't it, the rub is if you're trying to use these refillable, reusable systems, then how logistically do you make them work?
I think the computer has probably improved things a little bit by allowing backloading in a logical fashion.
Yeah, there is no doubt about it. I've kind of been in the back rooms of some of these really, really big corporations where they are, considering themselves logistical geniuses, and yet there's still a lot of unnecessary shipping here to shipping there. So, and the shipping, really, that's our biggest contributor to global warming. And so the more effective we get at that kind of thing, I think, way more important and way more important than how we package things almost.
Well, I think some of the container shipping on intermodal trains that don't ever discombobulate can handle things fairly gently, whereas mm-hmm. old train systems used to bump and shunt and hump, and
right.
you couldn't send delicate stuff with them. You couldn't send small lots. I think the whole system is encouraging, and in our own town, we have hundreds of these trains going past, and we don't have a hub for loading or unloading those particular trains. And I think it's a disadvantage, and it's somewhat a disadvantage from a packaging point of view.
Yeah, good point. Well, this is another reason that I think the best systems, it's not going to be necessarily a material solution just for what you said, okay? You have these loads that are vibrating that have to, you know, withstand all this stress. Well, what if you made the product stronger? So that you don't have to have all this internal heavy-duty shock-absorbing packaging around it. I mean, obviously, the packaging has to do its job, because if the computer printer or the refrigerator or the whatever doesn't get there in one piece, then you've squandered this huge amount of resources. And so the packaging is just sort of the skin on that particular item. But I think when the product designers work with the logistical people, work with the theft people, work with the marketing people. The marketing people actually have to be the last in the whole scheme. Work with the packaging designers. Then they can come up with these systemic solutions that actually, I think, get to the level of efficiencies that you're hoping for, and I think everybody ought to hope for.
Very good. That's where we have to leave it. We've used up the time. It went very quickly. Daniel Imhoff, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for listening to me. I appreciate it. The book is Paper or Plastic.
Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. The publisher, Sierra Club Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste Stan. Good afternoon, everyone. An interesting day at the Chicago Board of Trade. This morning on the opening bell, we saw soybean prices lower, but as the day wore on, it began to creep up. And by the end of the day, we saw double-digit increases in the soybean pit. Traders do not believe that remnants of Hurricane Dennis will make its way quite as far north as was originally thought on Friday when traders left for the weekend. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. And as we always do, we begin over in the wheat pit. July wheat, a high on the day of 329.5, a low of 323.5, settling 327, down 1.5. September, a high of 339, a low of 332.5, settling 335.25, down 2. December, a high of 352.5, a low of 346.5, settling 349, down 2.25. March, a high of 364, a low of 358, settling 361.25, down 1.25. July corn, a high of 228, a low of 222.5, settling 226.75, up a half. September, a high of 237.5, a low of 231.5, settling 235.25, up a half. December, a high of 249, a low of 242.5, settling 246.75, up a half. March, a high of 255.25, a low of 250, settling 253.75, up 3/4. May, a high of 258.75, a low of 253.75, settling 257.25, up 1.25. And July corn, a high of 261.25, a low of 256, settling 260, up 1 on the day. July oats, a high of 171.75, a low of 168.25, settling 171.75, up 2.75. September, a high of 178, a low of 171.5, settling 177, up 3.75. And then prices in the soybean pit. July, a high of 692, a low of 665, settling 688, up 12.5. August, a high of 696, a low of 668.5, settling 690, up 12. September, a high of 699.5, a low of 672.5, settling 694.5, up 13.25. And your harvest month, November, above $7 again, settling at 707. Make it 701.5 on the settlement, off a high price of 707 and a low of 679. January, a high of 708, a low of 681, settling 703.25, up 14.25. March, a high of 698, a low of 676, settling 695.5, up 15.5 on the day. July soybean meal, a high of 215.50, a low of 208.70, settling 214.60, up 330. August, a high of 216.20, a low of 208.50, settling 214.90, up 390. July soybean oil, a high of 24.96, a low of 24.28, settling 24.77, up 22. In the August, a high of 25.03, a low of 24.35, settling 24.86, up 21 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in Celeste, except for those pork bellies. It was a down day.
Sure was. Boy, feeder cattle took it hard today. August feeders, 112.20, the high 109.90, the low 110.12.5, the settlement, that down 185. September, 111.10, the high, 108.80, the low, 109 even the settlement, that down 202.5. October, 109.55, the high, 107.30, the low, the settlement, 107.52.5, down 207.5. August live cattle, 79.80, the high, 78.05, the low, 78.07.5, the settlement, that down 127.5. October, 83.30, the high, 81.77.5, the low, the settlement, 81.82.5, that down 132.5. July lean hog, 68.80, the high, the low, 67.60, the settlement, 67.65, that down 45. August, 67.40, the high, 65.45, the low, the settlement, 65.70, that down 112.5. October, 59.10, the high, 57.90, the low, the settlement, 58.07.5, that down 82.5. December, 55.95, the high, 54.80, the low, finishing at 55.25, that down 10 cents. In July, pork bellies, 60.80, the high, 59.20, the low, 60.70, the settlement, that was up 127.5. Let's take a look now at the Dow. It's up 58 points at 10,507. The NASDAQ up 17 points at 2130. The S&P 500 6 higher at 1217.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jason Fay from Regina, Canada writes, Dear Dr. Science, why does the water in the bathroom taste different than the water in the kitchen?
By a certain age, most of us have learned not to drink from the toilet. Some of us, usually potential scientists, dare to violate social norms in order to expand the sphere of human knowledge. Now, you seem to be one of those people. Toilet and tub water both contain contaminants, but even if they don't, part of the culinary experience is affected by setting. Try drinking from the toilet in candlelight, with Mantovani or John Tesh on in the background. Oh, and be sure to let me know how you're doing. Dr. Science cares.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD, featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com or call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Prairie Boatworks, Champaign, Lincoln Diagnostics,